Vampire.
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 Der Podcast über Frauen, die schreiben.
Der Podcast über Frauen, die schreiben.
Der Podcast über Frauen, die schreiben.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge von Vampire, dem Podcast über Frauen, die schreiben. Mein Name ist Rasha Khayat, ich bin Autorin, Übersetzerin, euer Host und die Erfinderin von Vampire. Heute freue ich mich sehr, Luby Barret als Gästin begrüßen zu dürfen und wir führen mal wieder ein Gespräch auf Englisch. Luby ist Autorin von Gedichten und Kurzgeschichten, Übersetzerin, Kuratorin, Literaturvermittlerin und wird demnächst den ersten englischsprachigen Buchladen und Cultural Hub in Hamburg eröffnen, Davenport Books. Sie nennt Davenport Books auch Room for Brave Conversations. Ich bewundere Lubys Arbeit als Literaturveranstalterin und Vermittlerin schon lange deshalb, weil sie immer neue Perspektiven und Türen öffnet. Zum Beispiel mit der Kuration des ersten Black Writers Festivals in Hamburg 2024 oder auch mit ihrer Reihe Framed, wo sie Musik und spannende, oft neue literarische Stimmen in öffentliche Orte im Stadtteil bringt. Mit ihrer Arbeit sorgt sie immer wieder dafür, dass die Literaturlandschaft vor allem in Hamburg, wo sie lebt, immer ein bisschen diverser und spannender wird. Mit Luby spreche ich über die französische Autorin Constance Debray. Wir sprechen vor allem über den zweiten Teil ihrer Romantrilogie Love Me Tender, aber auch über Debrays zwar schmales, aber extrem kraftvolles Werk, mit dem sie in den letzten Jahren in der Literaturwelt wirklich von sich reden gemacht hat. Wir sprechen über Mutterschaft, Queerness, toxische Beziehungen und wie die Inhalte eines Bücherregals manchmal tatsächlich zum Verhängnis vor Gericht werden können. Mich hat Luby mit ihrer Begeisterung für Constance Debray jedenfalls komplett angesteckt. Ich hoffe, euch wird's genauso gehen. Vampire wird von Katrin Albrecht und Asya Kurtuldu als Producerinnen betreut. Alles, worüber wir sprechen, findet ihr wie immer in den Shownotes verlinkt. Und wir freuen uns sehr, wenn ihr uns teilt, abonniert, weiterempfehlt und uns bei Spotify und Co. ein paar Sterne gebt. Ihr könnt auch Vampire-Podcast auf Instagram folgen. Und jetzt wünsche ich euch erstmal ganz viel Spaß beim Gespräch mit Luby Barret über Constance Debray. Luby, hi! Welcome to Vampire!
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm super excited to have you. This is such a nice opportunity also for us to have conversations we usually just have like off the record. And now we can, you know, with all my guests, we always like do a little warm up and always, like we also did just now, we just dive into things. Like, stop, we have to do this on the record. This is material.
But tell me something, Rasha. Am I the first English-speaking guest?
No, we had a couple of English-speaking episodes. We had my very good friend, Rumana Bujarovska. She was my first guest. She spoke about Roxane Gay. Then we have Lana Bastasic. She talked about Dubravka Uglesic. Mm-hmm. And we have my very good friend from the States, Shelley Oria, who talked about an anthology she did on reproductive freedom in the States. So we did that in English too. So you're number four.
Okay.
But all of you are special to me. So, Luby, you brought a French writer. And as it sometimes happens with Vampire, my guests suggest a writer I've never heard of before. And that's always super interesting and exciting for me. And you were so enthusiastic. And you said, you have to read her. It's amazing. And this is Constance Debray, it's a French writer. And the book you suggested is called Love Me Tender. But first of all, tell us, Constance Debray, who is she and how did she enter your life and earn your enthusiasm?
That's a great question because I don't remember. I tend to go with writers that other writers I admire are reading. So I'm sure it's somehow through that path that I found her. And I just chose this book because it's the first of a trilogy that I read. All of them are amazing. But this really captured me. And I guess it spoke deeply to the time I'm having in my life, right? So she's coming from an illustrious French family, and she's abandoned her marriage and her legal career and is also dating women at this point and writing. So this book is taking place. It's autofiction, I guess. I don't want to label anything, but it's not her in the book. It is a character, and she's very strong in saying that. And so we're in the book at this point where she's been estranged from her son, and the character is, and she's living in different apartments in Paris and swimming every day and writing. And you know, you're just kind of seeing the aftermath or or during the math, I could say, of this big decision that she's kind of made in her life. And for me as a woman and as a mother, this greatly appealed to me because I've been also slowly liberating myself since the divorce of my ex. And I also have two kids and I'm a single mother. And just I've been thinking so much about societal standards and cultural standards. I guess you could say this is something I've been fighting my whole life because I've coming from a country that's homogeneous. And I often talk about this. And then, you know, I think like most women, I didn't think deeply about marriage and I didn't think deeply about children per my conditioning. It was just something that was kind of expected and it would happen. And I fell into it. And of course, you start really thinking about these things as soon as you have children. At least me, the deep self-reflection really began because, you know, you are responsible for these children that's come in. And a woman, I started changing, you know, and I started to kind of see more clearly this glass box I've put myself in. Mm-hmm. How is I going to get out of this in a way that's very authentic and true to myself when all of society is telling me that I need to be a certain way, you know? So, and so this one is just, it's talking a lot about queer identity and freedom, you know, authenticity over, you know, conformity and liberation from, you know, maternal expectations. And it is just a fantastic read, short, you know, I guess chapters, you can say, profound, sentences, simple, as you know, most times the simple is profound.
Yeah.
And it just really grabbed me by the throat. And I often teach her during my seminars as well.
Ah, that's interesting because, well, you already touched on so many things. Like one of the first questions I have on my notes here, is it fiction? So you already tapped into that. We're going to talk about that. I read this also as if in a fever, like it's such a intense, and I don't want to say quick read in a bad way, it's just that you cannot put it down, you know, it's just you get sucked in. Also because the sentences are very short, it sucks you in, and then you're just like, okay, so what's gonna happen. And I also feel that she touches on a lot of very painful things, I would say. So one of the things that I've found really extreme, also something that I've never even thought about, I guess sometimes I'm a little bit naive, is her ex is, so the she starts out with a meeting that she's meeting her ex, and they've been separated for a while, and they meeting for the purpose that she wants to tell him that she's now dating women. Mm-hmm. And so she does, they sit down and she does, and he doesn't have any major reaction. He's like, okay, yeah, sure. But then he walks her home and he tries to get inside. Like she tries to get into her apartment and tries to kiss her, I guess. And she's like, no, and sends him away. And then a few days later, or a couple of weeks later, whatever, they meet again. And the same thing happens, that he's, you know, nice and he orders champagne. He gets a little bit drunk. And then again, he tries to sort of, yeah, get in with her. And after that, the shit hits the fan, basically, after she rebuffs him twice. Mm. And this happens in the first, I guess, 20 pages of the book, which is like, whoa, okay. So you can feel there's a lot of like fragile masculinity going on and a lot of hurt. So what he does then is really devious. Mm. When she files for a divorce, he applies for sole custody and for her to get stripped of all her maternal rights and visitation rights and everything on the grounds of incest and pedophilia.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. What was your reaction when you read this?
It's the same, but I've been through divorce, so.
Okay, you know how dirty it gets.
And that was the card that he could use. You know,
yeah.
So that's what I thought of, you know, because if that wasn't the case, you know, I think a lot of women, the card that's they use is like, let's do 50-50 so that they don't have any financial obligations. And then also like just talking badly about the mother in different ways. Of course, when I heard that, it's sad to say because of my own experience here in Germany with the social services and all that, I wasn't so shocked. But of course, I was outraged and angry that that this is always happening, no matter what country you're in, and how calculated it is. You know, mm-hmm. He was very calculating, and she's a lawyer.
That's exactly.
At the end of the day, you know, it doesn't matter what you are in the court of these laws. Like, you're a woman at best.
Yeah. That's what she also says, you know, so you can be everything you can. And at one point she also says, you know, outside everything is like equal rights and me too. Yeah. But in the end, you're just like the woman in the court who doesn't fulfill societal expectations and who's just wanting on every account. But she makes the point that, you know, not it's not shocking in that sense, but it just, to me, it's just so painfully clear. Yeah. In the beginning, when she talks about this, how he comes up with this accusation, she says, "I guess I'm hunting in their territory."
Yeah,
that, you know, that was just like, wow. Okay, so she managed to sort of insult his masculinity in every possible way. Not only did she separate from him and, you know, asked for a divorce, no, now she's also choosing to date women.
Yes.
And he wasn't, you know, his dick wasn't amazing enough to sort of, you know, fuck her back to her senses, so to speak, because he tried and she rebuffed him again. And so he comes up with this excuse and this, like, in general, just says, okay, like you also said, you know, this is the card he could use. That's really dark.
Yep.
But that also says so much about, like, gender relations, I felt.
Absolutely. And also just who what in the court of law, right, when you're in this, as well as for like the family courts and all that, they're always saying that this is in the best interest of the kid, but it's in the best interest of the father. It's always aligned with the father. You know, I had this issue all the time. It's like, what's best for the kids? We need to listen to the kids. But the father always has a right. But the father, right? I'm like, but what about the rights of the kids? No, but the father has a right. And what they're saying is the father has a right over the kids, you know, that his right is what we're upholding. And it's a spotlight on what society finds, you know, relevant, important, and what this institution of marriage is actually for, you know. What is it for? Who is it upholding? Who is it benefiting, you know? And I like this book because she asks a lot of questions. She's with abandon of what people think or care. And I think women and any person who is coming from a disadvantaged background, we need to start speaking this way. We need to start speaking in ways that are, I hate the word triggering because I don't believe in triggers. I think triggers is another thing that the patriarchy has put up so that, you know, we can kind of be in line. I think
I don't like it either, but
I don't care about it.
It really triggers me, the word triggering.
This is triggering, you know, like we need to hear these things and speak about them so openly, so directly, so in your face, because how else are we going to understand that we're all suffering from the same thing, and women, you know, are suffering from the same thing. So when I read these excerpts in my classes, the discussions are ferocious, you know.
Interesting. Tell me about that.
No, interesting, because the women are like judgmental. Not all of them, but some are like judgmental, and I'm always playing the devil's advocate. Well, why are you judging this character for what they're doing? And then it's like they start thinking like, why am I actually? Why am I saying these things? Why am I believing what I'm saying? Why is this triggering me, you know?
But are they judgmental of the female character, of the mother?
Yes.
Really?
Yes, from the stuff that that they're saying. You know, like, let's take, for instance, the beginning line in this book is, I don't see why the love between a mother and son should be any different from other kinds of love.
I think that's such an amazing opening line, though. It's such a great
Laura's box, you know. It's like,
yeah, it's also the way she's, you know, we don't want to spoil or anything, but I also thought the last paragraph was also amazing, you know, because she's like, I don't, the same way you feel about triggering, I feel about when people say, oh, this is such a brave sentence.
Yes.
I hate that. Yeah, like, yeah. You know, fuck them. Yeah. This is like the truth, you know, and I think the
women were triggered by it because, you know, they all have mothers, or most of them have mothers.
Yeah.
So it's this idea of like, is my mother not supposed to love me unconditionally?
Mm-hmm.
Why are we even comparing this holy pedestal kind of love and bringing it down to like every other kind of love, you know? And I love this examination of motherhood the expectations of like love in motherhood. You know, she even has a sentence in there saying she wrote a letter to her son she didn't mail.
Yeah. Asking, yeah.
Do you hate me? It's fine. You don't have to answer, but you can hate me. You should hate me. Actually, love is part of hate is part of love. Like, and this kind of I feel in the book, she's giving for those who don't feel liberated or haven't even thought about it, the permission. I don't like to say that. Mm. It is, you know, the permission to go there, to step outside of, give yourself grace in these judgments, but also step outside and examine them. You know,
I was thinking that maybe it's more like a possibility than a permission, maybe, you know, just like it's always, I feel like when someone opens a window that maybe hasn't been opened before in a larger sense, you know, because I'm not aware that I've read anything like this. Dense also, you know, because,
I think permission for those who, which most of us, I mean, let's be honest, I just got liberated a few years ago, like, are in captivity, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know? I think that's why I say permission, because when you're in captivity for so long, you're not thinking about possibilities. You are completely sold on where you're living, because you have to be. You have this, what is the syndrome? The Stockholm syndrome, you know? So it's like a permission is perhaps needed sometimes for those.
Yeah, no, I mean, I totally understand where that comes from. I'm just like, you know, I'm more the type of, who do I have to ask permission from? Come on, you know, it's like, yeah. I'm of age and I pay my own rent and I pay my own way. So, you know, I'm my own woman. But yes, I completely understand what you're saying, because also this idea of permission to narrate, you know, it comes to women, it comes to other minorities, people of color, we're all like, not only are we like captivated captives? Captives of like maybe like an institution such as marriage, but also, you know, patriarchy, but also white supremacy, all these like colonialism, all these systems that are in place that we're like slowly getting more and more aware of and finding language for. And obviously, I sometimes think it's also in all of us, especially in all of us, like in the older generation, as we are now, if we like it or not.
I know.
We both teach. So it's like, okay, so we have these kids in our classrooms or in our classes. But, you know, so for me, I feel like oftentimes it also comes with a sort of grieving process of realizing where we've been, you know, all this time. And I feel like she is this character in Debray's novel. She's taking it to the extreme, this kind of liberation, because this whole book is a part, half basically is about her struggle with, you know, grieving for this idea that she can be a mother in the sense that she maybe wants to be, you know, that she has a son in her life. And the other half is basically just her sleeping with women,
yeah,
you know, and exploring her sexuality in wild ways and in tender ways and, you know, with more intimacy or with like, sometimes they're all interchangeable. You know, she says she doesn't even remember their first names. She just like all calls them honey and, you know, that kind of thing. So that there is some sort of metamorphosis going on here. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, especially with the dealings with the women, right? It makes you think like, you know, don't men do this to us? Isn't this like how men treat women? And it makes you, I mean, I'm for the character, so I'm biased, you know, so I just want to understand the workings of this. And I believe in this liberation, this journey that they're going on.
Me too.
And let's understand, like, a lot of people find it shocking and whatnot, but it's been years, this character has been years already in it, you know? And they're not just busting out with this now, you know? Like, metamorphosis, as you're saying, it takes a while. Like, even when you decide to leave somebody, it's been 5 years in the working, whether you
absolutely
do it or not, you know? And also part of the book is also, you know, about her aristocratic family.
Yes.
And this is very interesting as well. So this is
it's a very French thing, I feel like.
Yeah. But, you know, it says aristocratic, but no money, you know, so just the same. And also like not what you expect aristocratic family to be, you know, like ex-addicts or current addicts. And at this point, the mother had already died and the father was ailing. what do I make of this metamorphosis? When I read something this liberating, you know, I want to know how they did it. I want to know.
Yeah.
How they did it. That's interesting. I literally bought the book, the St. Augustine, the one that they talk about in the Confessions of a Sinner, and read it. I was like, I didn't know. So for me, it's always I've always been seeking freedom. So when people are thinking this boldly and living a completely authentic self, I gravitate towards it voraciously. So I don't shy away from it at all. And I think it's fascinating. And I've learned a lot already reading it. And it's a book that you reread, you know, you see.
Yeah, I can already see myself getting back into it. Also, I really want to read the others now because it's, I remember it's similar, but completely different. Obviously, when I got obsessed with this trilogy by Deborah Levy, when she left her husband, you know, it's also, and there are similarities in the sense that there are three very short books, you know, and it's all liberation. It's obviously completely different. It's like a white woman in Britain with, you know, completely different background. But it's still, it's interesting that she also chooses this form of a trilogy. Yeah, I mean, let's talk about. I have a lot of other.
We can talk all day about constantly. I was going to say, I know.
No, because there are so many other topics that she touches on that are deeply feminist issues, I feel like. Mm-hmm. Maybe one thing that I found fascinating, and then we can dive into form because I find that also really interesting, is the fact that what really moved me. Maybe also because I'm a reader and a writer and because this is such a medieval thing, is her husband. Again, you're probably going to say, this is the stuff he just does. This, you know, he uses any and all social media posting by her friends, any likes he does, books, you know. Exactly. Crazy. I was going to talk about the books, you know, and that she's basically accuses her of bestiology. No, what is called bestiality? There's this English word that's, you know, called what I mean. And he uses these books to prove that she's a pervert, that she has, you know, in her library, and basically says, look at the books she reads. She's not a fit mother. And then she gets rid of them when she moves, first because she doesn't have a lot of space, but I'm sure also because, you know, this is what, you know, the court or her husband accuses her of being a bad mom. And what is this? You know, I've been thinking about Oscar Wilde, you know, it's like, okay.
You know, Arash, I don't know. This to me was very familiar because
really,
yeah, because my ex is, I hid all my books. Like I would turn the books over in the covers because I got always criticism like about what I'm reading, you know?
Wow. And
because it's a window of what I'm thinking or whatever their, you know, fear was of me educating myself, you know, in things that.
Yeah, there's no such thing as scary as an educated woman. Crazy, you know, it's crazy. Yeah.
And I remember that. And I would turn my books over. I just wouldn't show it or be, in my bag, particularly with one ex of mine. It just outright, like, what are you reading that for? You don't need to. That's weird. Like the.
Wow.
And it also for me in general, it's making me think whenever I'm out and about, like I never show what I'm reading, you know, I'm always kind of putting the cover down as I'm reading because I don't want people to have an inner look into my inner life, you know.
Wow.
I really value books have saved me, you know, it's been my inner world since I learned the English language and it's the place where I felt safe for such a long time and still do. And so I don't want people to know what I'm reading always. I mean, now, of course, I'm more open about it. I have my books, my library here at home, which I love for people to come to but these are people that I trust. Yeah, you know, not just people off the street, but I can see that. And it's like, it's almost, I'm like, well, now I understand, you know, like why I've been doing this. And it's, yeah, so for me, it wasn't, again, another shock because I kind of lived this, not to that extreme, of course, but this idea of, you know, what I'm reading signifies a bit of like what I'm thinking or how I think or what I, you know, a danger to whoever I'm with.
Yeah, to me that was, well, I mean, it's not crazy in that sense because, you know, banning books and burning books and, you know, getting rid of educational programs is the first rule of fascism, you know. And also, you know, keeping women uneducated for as long as we possibly can, keeping minorities uneducated as long as we can. That's like a systemic thing that we all know and are familiar with. It, coming back, making a popular comeback now, fascism today. But I never heard this in like a modern tale of a marriage. You know what I mean? Like on a private, I mean, I would associate this with like a 19th century thing, you know, with just Jane Austen, you know, the girl reads too much. She's never going to find a husband, you know, that kind of thing. But it really, like, it made me deeply sad for her and for you, as a matter of fact, now that you're telling me this, that, you know, this is something that is today even a thing, you know, that,
Evidence, right? And let's be honest, we're not talking about this often. I'm really glad that you brought it up because this is making me also think about my past and how I've been and all these red flags that I, you know, just kind of worked through. But it is, and let's be honest, a lot of part in the world, this is still the case, you know. Saying a woman who reads, a woman who's whatever educated is a dangerous person, you know. But I look at it as a way as that this was evidence for his case, you know, and anything that can corroborate his allegations he was going to use. But yeah, you're right about this particular spotlight about the book. We should kind of look into that a bit deeper and how many people who are maybe listening have had some kind of experience in this, you know.
Yeah, that would be, I mean, you know, she even gets the advice, like she's writing a book while she's going through this process, and she even gets the advice to not publish her book, to not give more evidence or more evidence, quote unquote, or more material to her husband's case. And she says, I mustn't shock the they tell me I mustn't shock the judges. You know, I must give myself a pen name, and I must grow my hair out because she has shaved her head. So they all want her to make herself pleasant and digestible and liked, which is, I think, something every woman knows, you know, to some extent, to just like make yourself, like, I've always been told that I talk too much, that I talk too loud, that I'm sometimes too emotional. No, often too emotional. So, you know, this, like, this is my thing that, you know, I get really like triggered, as we just said, you know, by.
I'll give you a great example. I
Yeah, please.
never spoke about this publicly, but I'm going to tell you. You know, I have a caseworker at the Jugendamt who is completely biased, and a bunch of other things, as you can imagine. We had a meeting with her, and she did a deep search on me on the internet, as a
Wow.
writer, brought in one of my stories as kind of evidence of what she thinks my behavior is towards this separation with, you know, that happened in our family. And trying to allege which is a story that I wrote about my father, trying to allege the relationship that I have with my father and why I'm being the way I am with my ex. Can you imagine? And she
That's
printed it out and
insane.
added, yeah. And
That's insane.
luckily for me, I learned, you know, I learned through all this process. I always have my lawyer with me, and my lawyer, I have told her already because she said this to me on the phone. She's very smart, this woman, because she doesn't do any kind of paper trail.
Yeah, no paper trail, yeah.
And I told my lawyer, she's like, this can't be. All the years I've been working, my case to my lawyer is crazy because she can't believe all the things I've endured. And now she's understanding, like, it's a racist system and a very much a system against women. And when she was in this meeting and she saw that this woman printed it out and brought it, and everybody was just like, and she, you know, my lawyer went after her, right? Now you have, you know, now you're being gaslighting. Now you've overstepped your boundaries as a worker. So yes, you know, even my own words can be twisted and used against me in my personal life. You know, what does this have to do with me? What is my work as a writer, as a creative, as you don't even understand where I came from or if this is true or not, or doesn't matter. Like, to use that in a way to suppress my rights in this system. So that's what I...
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing this story. I'm really like, wow. It's, again, you know, it's the stuff of fiction, but I guess fiction also comes from somewhere. But I now understand even more how you, you know, how this spoke to you so much. I understood before because it's just a really, really great book. But now seeing, you know, all the personal connections you're sharing, what can you tell us about the other books? I'm sure you read all of them.
Yeah. So this was kind of an extenuation, extended. Yeah. I don't know. Right. My English has gotten so much worse since being here for 12 years. It's an extension, I should say, of this story. But not, I think this one is more focused on.
But this is the second one, the middle one.
I know. So the other ones go more, there's one that goes more into the family, which is very interesting. This family structure, her background, you know, the visiting the ailing father in the countryside, and then also one with dealing with the women that they're seeing. So, but obviously this one spoke to me the most because I read it, and it's really a lot about, you know, this kind of motherhood expectations and conformity.
Yeah. So you already touched, already when you started telling us about the book, you says that you said that she's very adamant that this is fiction and the writer that is.
No, I wouldn't say that. So it's obviously similar to her own life. I don't want to speak for her in any way.
No, of course not. No. But just
but she's adamant that this is a character, and she's very into the also the as you were saying, the form. So I had the privilege of seeing her speak in Berlin.
Yeah, tell us about that.
DAAD Gallery. I was waiting for months until she came, and she was the S. Fischer guest lecturer at the Free University, Freie Universität Berlin. And of course, packed room, you know, and just as commanding presence. And I love it. It's just kind of like no nonsense kind of way, you know. And this character, and as well as her, is so focused, you know. And so when you're asking questions that not interesting, it's not interesting and not in their path, you know. But talked a lot about character, talked about form and the book, and was very specific about that they're, you know, not the same thing, her life and this character's life necessarily, completely. Yeah, and it was wonderful. She's a great lecturer. I wish I went to the seminar that she was doing, or the that she was teaching, because I think there's a lot I could learn from how this book was written. But it's obviously written from somebody who is like this character, stripped down everything down to just the essentials. Which also was very interesting for me to read, of how one can be, how what it takes to write a book like this, what it takes to be able to be so focused on your craft, you know, like the swimming daily, you know, counting down what she's wearing and what she owns, and also just like all these things happening to her. She goes, that's fine, that's okay. Like, it's just, they're like in a bubble in a way that's Teflon, that all these things that are, because the decision has already made where this life is going and how they're going to live it. And therefore, that is what extreme focus is. That's somebody that has come radically into their own self, you know? And that's very appealing to me, you know, because this is something I'm trying to do at this stage of my life, and trying to quiet down all the things that are constantly being thrown at me and not biting at them, or giving it a day or two to mull over or think about. So you see her as a very self-actualized, as a human being. So, yeah.
We're going to put a link in the show notes, because that very lecture is still available on YouTube. I actually watched it. I concur. It was very impressive to see her and being very like, yeah, like you said, focused and everything. I just still find it very interesting that, I mean, this is also often, we don't understand, we don't know, a publisher's decision, that this copy that I have here has her on the cover, you know, and it doesn't...
All of them. Sorry? All three books have her.
Yeah, and it doesn't say novel, you know, so it's like already... And it doesn't say anything, which is fine, you know. I think books should not have a label on them, except for if they are in fact crime novel or whatever. You know, I just think books should just have titles on them. And because I think these labels, especially in Germany, where they're all adamant that everything should be a novel, is extremely limiting and very boring in my opinion. But yeah, that made me think, because this is probably also naive of me, because I watched the lecture only after I finished reading this. So I read this, again, very naively and not very scholarly, being a literary scholar myself, as an autobiography, an autofiction, at least, you know. And then she sits there in the first 5 minutes of the lecture and, you know, they talk about the novel and this is a novel and she's a novelist. And I'm like, what are you even talking about? She's like on the cover, you know. So that like sort of messed
They are, up. Right? So she, I think for her, it's the same. She's not interested in genre. Like it doesn't matter what other people are saying about it. And let's be honest, like the genre has just been not the best thing for women or, you know, like, or necessarily people of color, you know, to being put into a genre. And I love that. I love how everything about this book, also, like you're saying, I don't know who chose the picture, but not putting anything on there.
Yeah. You know, yeah. I mean, I have like my goal for my next book is literally just have like a cover that is a color, you know, preferably my favorite color, maybe pink. You know, or red, and then just my name and the title. I don't want anything else on the. Maybe not pink, because well, maybe yes, because I don't care, honestly. Because I was gonna say, then this is going to be a certain, you know, meshed in a certain genre again. But
you know, pink is originally a boy's color.
Is it?
Yeah, you should do some research on that. It's originally a boy's color, and then obviously with all this mass marketing, it's become a girl's color.
How was it a boy's color? And how do you know that also?
I read it somewhere a long time ago that it said, you know, about colors and pink being originally male color, boy color, and that somehow it morphed into, with capitalism, that it's become a very, you know, girl-centric color. But yeah.
I mean, in general, I don't care about this thing because it really literally is my favorite color, has always been, so, you know, and I also really don't care that it's like associated with girlish things. I am confident enough in my, you know, whatever I am, I don't know that I can. But anyway, this is beside the point that I don't want to have anything on my cover for my next book.
You know what? You should update everybody on how that goes with the publisher. I would love
to
know.
Yeah, yeah. You will all see the book. Well, I mean, first I have to write it, but then we'll see. I thought it was really lovely and interesting what you said when you said that she just sits there as a completely self-actualized being, and this is something you're pursuing at this stage of your life. Do you think, because I think that, I mean, she's very successful, Constance Debré is now, you know, although I have never heard of her before, which is weird that, you know, someone being so successful, and her books are published in German, but by a very small publisher. So this tells you something again about
the canon, right? Like what voices are being.
Well, I mean, this is an ongoing thing in Vampire, that either the books are not available in German at all, or they're just like out of print or whatever. So usually my writer guests bring in extremely interesting books that the German mass market publishing deems not worthy of publication. But what I was gonna say is there's always this idea that this radical kind of change is something extremely male, you know, like in males we celebrate it. And it's cool and it's like, wow, you know. For women, society is not that forgiving. But I think when you also say this is inspiring for you and for your life, I feel like we all should learn from her to just not give a fuck, right?
Yeah. It's interesting that you say that radical changes are celebrated for men. You're right. I mean, women are changing more than men, in my
opinion. All the time.
So, like, we're making, whether you call
it... Even physically.
Or, yeah. The physically part is a... Like, I'll give you, for instance, I love watching Law & Order, and now I'm watching the first season, and, you know, up to the last, and you see Mariska, the detective Benson, like a young, you know, whatever 20-year-old, you know, body in the first season. Then you see her changing, and you know, all the people around her, they're getting middle age, you know, but not as profoundly changing as her. She's beautiful, and I was like, wow, how beautiful is that? You know, how beautiful to see her range physically, to see that. But going back to the radical changes, yeah, I mean, I think this is a completely patriarchal world. So
yeah, of course,
they get the marketing, but let's be honest. I changed so much in, you know, 40 plus years on this earth. And again, it's, you know, the marketing is not toward driven towards us to celebrate any of our small or big wins. Those that are close to us, that know us, we know what transformations we're doing on a daily, weekly, monthly, yearly basis. And you're right. This is why I do what I do with one of the main things I do for the work that I do is I want to bring these kind of voices out to the forefront, and just this kind of thinking, this kind of freedom, these pursuits, you know, this trigger free, you know, discussions, not trigger free, but like not worrying about triggers, so that we can become the spotlight in this world, and to understand that we've been talking about a lot of these things that's already been happening and changing and feeling.
I love that you say that, because now you gave me the perfect segue actually to talk about something I was really hoping and eager to talk to you about, because you do so much in the literary world. We know each other from Hamburg back in the day when I used to live there, and you're a writer, you're a translator, but you're an organizer of events, you're a curator, you teach. Now, can we share what your plan is for next year?
Yeah.
You're going to open a bookshop.
Cultural space. It's called Davenport. It's a cultural space and bookshop, of course, because we need books to be able to funnel into what's the most important part, the cultural aspect of this. English language.
Yeah, exactly. So you do so much. Tell us a little bit about that, because what I also find from following what you have done and are doing, especially in a city like Hamburg for so many years, is like you're always doing very interesting things that are like left of center, shall we say.
Yeah.
How did you get, like, can you sort of think back how this all started and how you decided to kind of, oh, no, I'm just going to go my own way?
I like that you said left of center. It wasn't for lack of trying, Rasha, you know?
Yeah, well, the same, you know, we all try.
Well, meaning I don't really care about the mainstream, but like what I mean is it wasn't for lack of trying to get funding to become.
Oh, none of us do, but then we know who gets the funding.
Yeah. Well, you know, I came here 12 years ago. I always say newly married, pregnant and barefoot. No, but, you know, literally like, yeah, you know, barefoot of the security of friends and family. Let's be honest. And of course, I went back. I've always, you know, books. I had people sending me books from the U.S. I would give them lists of what I needed. And just voraciously looking for bookstores here to kind of find my community, finding my footing. And there was a secondhand bookshop and food place with which to me wasn't what I'm looking for. It wasn't like an independent bookshop in the sense that I grew up with. So the lack was there. Lack was everywhere. And I just learned that I let my ambitions kind of guide me. So I put the cart before the horse. You know, I joined a reading series as a moderator and curator without having done much moderation and learned on the spot how to moderate.
This was Found in Translation already?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It was such a great reading series in Hamburg also. Yeah. It was one of the most interesting events that I've visited there always.
Yeah. So I learned how to moderate and I knew how to curate. I mean, living in all these different countries, you have to curate your own worlds all the time. But moderate was
I love that. You have to curate your own worlds. Yeah. That's such a good set. I'll write that down.
We have to, you know. And so then I just kind of splintered off to independent reading series and then in the end, just my own, you know. So, getting some crucial people who supported me, like the Writer's Room, Hartmut, he's still a main supporter of mine. And getting some support sometimes from the Cultura Biherde or from various organizations, et cetera. And I just learned that I need to build what I don't see. you know?
Mm-hmm.
This is literally, it sounds cliche or whatnot, but there was not going to be a place here that's dedicating to the English language writers that are around and also Germans who are interested in English and global stories. So I did this, and with the reading series, I always I always put in English language and German because this is important for me because I live here as well, and always well established to up and coming because I love this kind of connection where they can kind of bounce off of each other. And you were in one of them.
Yeah, I was in and I was in Framed, and I also was in Found and Translation.
Yes. And so that's just what I've been doing, and you know, I just put my head down and I just do the work. And I like that you're acknowledging the work I've done because I'm not invited to a lot of the things here in the German literary scene. And that's fine. I've come to terms with that. It's completely fine because I'm not doing what they're doing. But what I do fight for is the inclusion of people like me, which means people who don't have German as a first language, having the access or understanding even how to get the access to the plethora of of things that people writers can have here. So whether it comes to like a space to write, funding, festivals, readings, etc., the right people. And it's a very incestuous small place here where the same people are winning the same prizes, and you know, hands are washing each other, and friendships are rooted in stone. And that's not inspiring to me. It's not interesting to me. I'm interested in building up people who need the space, supporting young writers, older writers. And so I always was like, I need to open up something here. I need to open up a space. And I've been thinking, and I've been working corporate in the last 7 years, and I'm always kind of building on the side of how to do this. Worried, scared. I need the, you know, I need the stability or the so-called stability of working a corporate job, and it was just go time, you know. This was like ended it, and I was like, there's no other time to do it but now. And now I understand all the stories I've been hearing and reading, and the people I've met that said just do it. All the bookstores that have lent me their ear and their time in Hamburg, but specifically also in Berlin or in Amsterdam and London, like all this, they just said just do it. And I'm like, well, what should I look out for? So yeah, I'm launching Davenport Books. It's a cultural space and bookshop dedicated to the English language, which means there's going to be author reading, workshops, festivals, everything that you can think of around building the English language, and I will be drawing from the vast network that I've built throughout these years.
I think you might remember when you told me about this, I was so incredulous that there is no English bookshop in Hamburg. I was like, this cannot possibly be true, but it is. It's insane that a city as large and as supposedly worldly, you know, with so many people coming in from all over the world and forever also, has been part of the fabric of the city, which they are so proud of. Das Tor zur Welt, they call themselves.
You know? It's really only the tour, as we said.
Yeah.
I mean, I have come to terms here in heaven.
Yeah.
You know,
we don't have to talk about this. This is a very insidery conversation. Yeah. But just lest you all know, the Hamburg literary scene is sometimes, you know, they should be grateful to have Luby there to shake it all up a little bit. And I can't wait. I cannot wait to visit Davenport Books and to send everybody there. So you all should support Luby and her amazing work.
That's really kind of you. And I'm inclusive. So I don't have any, it's not, I don't think about competition or whatnot. I want to work with everybody, German writers that are interested in translating their works, because we'll have a big translation part of that as well. And it's just a place. So my tagline is, you know, a meeting place for brave conversations. And we were talking about brave. And I'm using brave and not in that way, like, oh, I feel brave enough to do this. It's more like a substitute for safe space, because there's no safe space.
I also say that
in my workshops. But we have to have a place where we're brave enough to be able to speak about the things that we're worried about, scared about, you know, et cetera. So that part in the bravery.
Yeah, I love that so much, because I've been thinking, especially these last few years in Germany, where politically it hasn't been the greatest time, especially for people of color, people with migrational biographies, whatever. It's just not very cozy. And I've been thinking about this too, to have like a space where you, because culture, you know, as much as I would love to switch to, let's say, nursing to feel like I'm doing something actually useful for the society, you know, I feel like, okay, so I've been in writing, publishing, culture my whole life. And like you also said, I love that, that you said that before, that, you know, books were your safe space. It was the same for me. You know, I came to Germany when I was 10 and I, you know, whereas I could speak the language, my reading wasn't good because Latin letters only came from, because I was in an American school, so I could read English and I could write in English, so, but German wasn't there. So, you know, part of learning my spoken and read German was reading and being in libraries and having the safe space and looking for stories where I could like make sense of the story that I am about to build as a little girl, you know. And so I always feel like being a writer now, as I am lucky to be, there's really no other reason to do this if I cannot, you know, use this voice and use the space that I am given for exactly what you're talking about, you know, to have conversations that we all need to have. Mm. Like, I'm not interested in having events that are just entertaining, you know, where people can come and have like a glass of wine and laugh a little bit and then go home, you know. And I want literature to be an art, and, you know, any kind of conversation to be a place for metamorphosis, as you have it, what we were talking about now. And so I really love that, especially that it's like a safe space. And I'm seeing more and more of this, I have to say, online, that people are, especially women, creating these spaces, which, you know, should also tell us a lot about women of color also doing this a lot. And where I feel like this should tell us something about our society.
Well, I think you're doing this with Fempire, by the way. And your very existence in the literature scene is absolutely important, you know. So I love the way you use your voice and how, you know, you support people and who you invite. And the conversations I have with you are always eye-opening and insightful.
Thank you.
And what you were saying is completely right. That's why I got into moderation, because I was so tired of seeing bad moderators here.
Oh my God, me too. I hate it so much.
These amazing minds that are flying from everywhere, and what are we giving them? Like,
I know,
you know, because they're a famous journalist or whatnot who clearly didn't read the book and, you know, essentially ends up talking only about themselves. And
I remember once, excuse me for interrupting, but this is like a story I love to tell in that context. It's like I was still living in Hamburg, so I traveled from Hamburg to Berlin to see Arundhati Roy speak. Exactly. And the moderator was like some famous German journalist woman, you know, I don't remember who it was. And the moderation was so bad that I actually left halfway through. Yeah. And I still cannot believe that I did, because I traveled exclusively for this reading to see one of the greatest living writers, you know, who came all the way from India. And then this, you know, it was the ELB, International Literaturfestival Berlin. So it was at the Berliner Festspiele. Oh. It was packed, of course, you know.
Yeah, but it's like, it's again, who is this servicing, right? I think like the institution around that has to change, you know?
And yes, absolutely. I completely agree.
Trust the audience more, or just like not, you know, don't invite these international authors and then just give them somebody who speaks fluent German but barely English, you know?
I completely agree.
You know, you should be the other way around, let's be honest, yeah? And so I had the same experience here at a festival in Hamburg, and I asked to be a moderator, and I was told, well, you know, it's Hamburg, so they speak German. I'm like, okay, so... I still went to it, and the it was some bookster grammar as a moderator, and it was absolutely horrible. Even the
who was the writer?
The writer from Nightboat. Oh, sorry, Nightbitch, not Nightboat. Nightboat is a publisher. Nightbitch, and so I stayed through the whole thing, excruciating, and it, just so I could tell the author, like, I wanted to moderate you.
Good.
Like, I was here for you, you know? And he was also kind of like, what happened? You know, this was this whole experience. And but I kind of want to let her know, like, I came here for you. I love your work. This is a great book. You know, excuse how our city showed up for you in that, in the sense of moderation. But yeah, I think we need to have better moderators.
Yeah, we need to have a better cultural landscape
or to have
at all.
Better, you know, readers to have better better conversations, as you're saying. Sorry.
Yeah, it's just, you know, again, you know, what are we using the spaces and our voices for? You know, are we using it to really like tell stories that might change us? Mm-hmm. You know? Like you also, you know, with Constance Debré, you're saying, you know, this is really inspiring because you see yourself. I have this experience, you know, when I read things. I'm so inspired always by my vampire guests and by what they bring. And can we create the spaces for that? And just, I sometimes feel, I had an interview recently about this on another podcast, about basically the racist structures in the literary business and in Germany, about how exclusionary it is, you know, that it's just not including more and more people. Like we are getting, I mean, we are an immigrant society anyway, but now, like, you know, there is a second generation of immigrant kids of age already who have, you know, university degrees and who are interested and who want, and they're not being served, you know. So good for you that you're opening a space now in Hamburg too to have like all of these people finally having a space where they can find what they, I'm sure, are looking for also. So
you said exclusionary, it's right. Another reason why I became a curator, I became anything, because I need to see more diverse people, like not just ethnicities, but backgrounds, age, language, etc. And I, you're right, like there's events that happen in Hamburg that I have no knowledge of until it happened. They're like, oh, we brought in all the cultural curators here, all the people working in literature. I'm like, why wasn't I invited? Like, who was there? Main people. And I'm like, who's curating this event, you know? And it goes on. But I love that you said, like, we need more space like this. And I thought so much about this all the years. But what we need to get these spaces, I mean, space is a privilege, just more conversations, you know?
Yes.
More conversations have to happen with people who are leading these brave conversations, you know, and not just moderators who are spewing the same kind of five questions about whatever.
How autobiographical is your work? It's one of the favorite questions.
I mean, now that the social service are going to be listening into this podcast, it's fiction.
Oh, damn. Everything is fiction.
No, it's not fiction. Come on, let's be.
No, of course. Luby, we've talked so much. Thank you so, so much for everything you bring to the literary world. Again, I feel like they should all be lucky and celebrating the fact that you're there and that what you bring and what you add to it. And you're not being celebrated enough. I want to emphasize this once again. And thank you again so, so much for bringing me Constance Debré into my life, because I, as you can see, you guys cannot see, but Luby can see that I have a lot of post-its in my book. So I'm sure we will be thinking about this a lot. So yeah, thank you so much for your time and for this lovely, lovely conversation.
Thank you so much, Rasha. You're doing something that is so powerful and so needed here for this country and everywhere, to be honest. The kind of conversations you're having is amazing. And I'm literally privileged to be here. And I thank you. So,
Mutual Appreciation Society, thank you so much.
Das war die neue Folge von Vampire, dem Podcast über Frauen, die schreiben. Diesmal mit der Literaturveranstalterin, Kuratorin, Autorin und Übersetzerin Luby Barret, mit der ich über die französische Autorin Constance Debré gesprochen habe. Vampire wird von Katrin Albrecht und Asya Kurtulu als Producerin betreut. Wie immer könnt ihr alles in den Shownotes finden, worüber wir gesprochen haben. Und wenn ihr uns teilt, abonniert, weiterempfehlt und ein paar Sterne bei Spotify und Co. gibt, dann freuen wir uns natürlich sehr. Folgt uns auch bei Instagram unter vampire-podcast. Mein Name ist Sadascha Hayat, Autorin, Übersetzerin und euer Host von Vampire. Und bis zum nächsten Mal, euch allen eine schöne Zeit.